Well, hello, and welcome to The Sacred. I'm your host, Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our deepest values and how we might better navigate the many, many things that we as a society disagree on. Every week, I speak to someone with some kind of public voice from a huge range of disciplines, perspective, points on the political and religious compass. I'm not sure about the plural there, but we're going to go with it. And I ask them to reflect on what is sacred to them, the ways their childhood has formed them, and what they've learned about how to deal with difference. As always, if you are enjoying the podcast, if it's provoking new thoughts or helping you reflect or building empathy in any way, please do leave us a review, share an episode with a friend, or give us a quick rating. It really helps other people to find us. In this episode, you'll hear a conversation I had with Grace Olmsted. Grace is an American journalist, and she's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the American Conservative, among many others, and usually with a family or a farming focus. She's recently written a book called Uprooted, which explores the effects of the rural brain drain on farming communities, the huge ecological problems that global agribusiness brings, and questions in a very personal way whether our association of success with cosmopolitan mobility, you know, promising children are told they'll go far, is actually really problematic for our communities. I really enjoyed hearing about her own personal wrestle as someone who has left a rural community to join the much maligned metropolitan intelligentsia. And I really valued hearing her locate her pro-life views in terms of what she calls a consistent pro-life ethic, i.e. she's not just anti-abortion, but that spills over into a much wider range of issues and a questioning of a consumerist or throwaway approach to life. It was also really noticeable. I asked her to come on the program because I'm always wanting to speak to more conservatives. For some reason, conservatives tend to respond less readily to my invitations to come on The Sacred. But she spoke about how, as someone who very recently would have called themselves a conservative, she feels like the movement, particularly in the States, has moved so far that she doesn't know if she can find herself at home there anymore. I really hope you enjoy listening. Gracie, I'm going to land you right in the deep end of a conversation with no warming up with our usual chit-chat conversations by asking you, what do you hold sacred? And you've had a little bit of time to think about it, but for new listeners, guests can take this wherever they like. It doesn't necessarily have to be religious. In fact, it's often not. But you're trying to try and bracket out our family or particular people in our lives and try and think about the principles or the values that we at least hope to live by. And one of the ways to get to it is if someone paid you to give this up, you'd feel that sort of disgust or ick reaction. What came up for you when you've had time to reflect on it?
I almost feel as if I need another several months to reflect on it because it is such a wonderful question to think through. But as I've pondered it, the main things that have come to mind is that I believe in the sacred nature of life, the dignity that ought to be afforded to all life. I believe in the world as creation, made and loved and sustained by God. And I believe in our creatureliness and thus that we have a role in that work that He's given us. I believe life in the world is a gift to be treasured and stewarded and cherished lovingly. I love how Norman Wiersbe has said that creation is not a vast lump of valueless matter. It is God's love made visible and fragrant and tactile.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure that some of those threads, we'll be able to pick them up as we talk about topics later on in our conversation. But first, I really want to zoom back and locate you in your story to get a sense of where you've come from, what has shaped your voice. So I'd love you to tell us a bit about your childhood and in particular, any big ideas that were in the air, political, philosophical, religious, or other. They might not have been spoken, but they have formed you in some way.
Well, I was raised in rural Idaho, in the western part of the United States. My great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents all the way back were poor farmers in that area who lived in small communities and were very much characterized by their evangelical Christian faith. And that was something that my father inherited from his parents in the sense that he was raised in the church and it deeply formed his identity and his beliefs. My mother actually was raised in a home that was secular, but as a young woman struggled with an eating disorder that came to the point of almost killing her. And it was during that time that she was introduced to Christianity, and that formed her life in a way that then was fully transforming and healing for her. And so she met my father not long after that point. And then, of course, me and my siblings came along. But as I reflect on kind of the things that formed them, I see a deep sense of the importance of communal involvement and service, stewardship, love for one's neighbor, generosity, and gratitude as marked by the Christianity that I saw. There was also, however, I think, in a lot of the evangelical Christian world that I grew up in, a struggle with legalism that was very difficult to kind of pick out as I grew older. And I was home.
Do you want to just say a little bit what you mean by that? Because lots of listeners won't be familiar with the sort of term legalism in that Christian sense.
Growing up in evangelical Christianity, and especially in a section of evangelical Christianity, which I was homeschooled. And so I was part of a homeschool group and that tended towards some fundamentalism, although I'm very lucky to say my parents themselves resisted that. Even as we saw many people in our community struggle with it. There was obvious tendencies toward trying to achieve one's goodness and to follow rules as opposed to embracing the love of God for what it is, as something not earned but given. I've been reflecting a lot on how Rowan Williams says that the cross is a symbol of the absolute and utter freedom of God's love, that it is something that we can never earn, but that is given to us despite ourselves. And yet, I think that oftentimes the subliminal messaging in a lot of churches that I knew growing up and in a lot of people that I knew was that there was something, some forms of service or of expectation that we had to follow in order to mark that we were good people. Sadly, I think a lot of those forms of legalism did not even accord with what I see in the gospel in the Beatitudes. And I think that oftentimes it was marked instead by a lot of posturing that was apart from the life of Christ. But all that to say, I find that in my teen years, as I kind of grappled with what I saw in Christianity, sort of the purity culture messaging that was also a part of that, that much was centered around sexual ethics and what we did or did not do with our bodies is apart from a lot of the messages that Christ gave us about the gospel. I began to struggle as well with a sort of existential crisis and wondering what in the world was real, what I could trust. Was my body good? Could it be good in and of itself as a created thing? And right around the ages of 14 to 16, I struggled daily with deep questions about my faith and what was real and whether it was possible to even understand the nature of reality. And as I emerged from that season of my life, I really began to turn more to the Gospels to see the love of God as something freely given. And I began to see our bodies as something good and the world itself, the creation he's made, as something good that we ought to be doing a work of preserving. And just continue to think about these questions, I think, more and more as I've grown older. That's just the beginning of an answer.
It's wonderful. And How, I know you, in your book, you write about Grandpa Dad, who was a farmer. How much was the life of the farm, that agricultural rural rhythms around you growing up? Or did it feel like something that had been more part of your parents' childhood?
It was definitely a part of our seasons. We lived in a rural community, and so we would have these seasons in which we would either visit the farm or get to be a part of its harvesting rhythms. My grandpa, great-grandpa grew corn, sweet corn, specifically to give away, which I talk about a bit in the book, about how he loved to actually just grow this crop for friends, family members, members of his church. And I would sit next to him and shuck this corn, and we would cook it and freeze it. And this was a way in which the fruit of the earth became a very tangible part of my life. And his rhythms of love and service to community became something that blessed me in a very tangible and embodied way. And so I learned so much from him. And I also, as I grew older, began to see how the life that he lived in place blessed his community to such a large degree, because he not only worked so hard to bless his church community, but was incredibly involved in the larger community and its well-being, and cared very much about the health of his land and of his neighbors. And so even as my father was not a farmer, the farm and our larger kind of rural context was very much a part of how we lived, created these sort of liturgical rhythms, I think, in which we were constantly passing through new seasons and thinking about the way that the feasting would then fold into the ways in which we practice Thanksgiving. And so that was very much a powerful part of growing up for me, and something that definitely has impacted the way I think about home and about the land itself and place.
I want to ask you about politics, and I'm always aware of feeling like a bit of a babe in the woods as a Brit about American politics, because in one sense we know loads in a slightly weird, like, obsessive ex-girlfriend way, in the sense of, like, you know, the West Wing, and follow most people interested in politics broadly in the UK also follow US politics, but sometimes it feels like as a, like, soap opera. And I'm also aware that our categories don't really map that well. But my understanding coming through in the book, and also reading some of your journalism, is that you certainly would... It sounds like you have some skepticism towards political parties, but you'd temperamentally sit in broadly in a conservative camp, tribe, position. How would you describe yourself politically, and maybe how much of that was related to your childhood, do you think?
Well, I was raised in a state that is extremely right-leaning and Republican and libertarian in its inclinations. I would have called myself conservative, even probably a few years ago. At this point, I struggle to feel that that label has any use or purpose, because in part, I think our political parties have become so entrenched here in America, along sides that actually don't equate with what I believe to be good or with a true Christian ethic, that I feel it actually does a lot of harm to say at this point that I'm a Republican, or that I will remain a Republican regardless of what the Republican Party does. And I haven't voted Republican in many years now. As to conservative itself, I resist the label oftentimes because I found that a lot of conservatives seem to embrace a reactionary approach to politics, in which the past is always better than the present. Progressivism, or any view that we could change or improve upon the past, is in and of itself bad. And there then becomes this very strong impetus on the right and through conservatism to not be willing to grapple with the extreme brokenness in our past, both as a country and within conservatism and with Christianity, to not be willing to grapple with the reality of white supremacy or systemic racism in our country, for instance, and to not be willing to criticize capitalism and free markets when and where they have not helped serve human flourishing or the dignity of human beings. And so I have struggled very much to find a way to continue to comment on politics in a way that feels valuable, except to continue to take every position that I hold back to my faith, back to the Beatitudes, and to question whether it is according with what I see there or whether it is pulling away from it. And if it's pulling away from it, to abandon it. And I think Simone Weil wrote a small book at one point on the abolition of all political parties. And she said, and I'm going to quote her because I can't improve upon her, just that one cannot serve both God and mammon. If one's criterion of goodness is not goodness itself, one loses the very notion of what is good. And she suggested that the partisan spirit makes people blind, makes them deaf to justice, pushes even decent men cruelly to persecute innocent targets. And when I think about what we saw through the Trump administration, the way that we treated immigrants and refugees, the positions taken on police brutality, I felt that it was such an impoverished thing to call oneself pro-life in the midst of what I saw going on in that moment, if I was not willing to define it outside of what the Republican Party and what conservatives at that point were holding up. And so I have written a few pieces about in response to conservatives asking me, what would you define conservatism as? I've tried to write some things reflecting on what would it look like if conservatism were defined by modesty, prudence, by desire for conservation of the natural world, and by love and compassion and gentleness. I would love to be a part of that if that were what conservatism looked like in the future. But I don't know whether it will just be something very different from that.
So talk to me about being pro-life. And you've written a little bit about having a consistent life ethic. And I think that that language isn't so familiar for UK listeners. What do you mean by it?
A consistent life ethic would be one in which we prize and protect life from conception to natural death. And that involves opposing violence and death in many ways that a lot of people on both sides of the political aisle might find uncomfortable. For instance, opposing the death penalty is something many on the right are not willing to do. Opposing proxy wars or speaking out against the injustice of the atrocities we see someplace like Yemen and the policies we've taken that have hurt people there. But in addition, it would mean being radically on the side of the unborn and protecting life in the womb, while also, it's important to note, seeking to support women and their lives and making sure that they are cared for and nurtured and supported. It would mean being on the side of the poor and having very strong opinions about how we are conserving or stewarding the earth and all the life that it contains, actually caring about the extinction of species, wanting to be good stewards of soil and water and natural resources. It would mean that we would be very much on the side of the marginalized and the oppressed, and that their lives would be ones that we seek to protect and to come alongside, and that rather than seeking to have policies which harm or bar people from goodness or prosperity, that we are seeking to do whatever is in our power to come alongside them and to better their lives and to make sure that their dignity is respected. And so it is a set of thoughts which Charles Camozzi has kind of talked about as opposing throwaway culture, that we live in this time and age in which much of life is seen as disposable, in which we live in a very extractive and exploitative age.
It's just it's helpful and refreshing to hear something of that breadth. And I know in the States, and to a lesser extent here, although discussions around abortion are usually pretty muted, it's really interesting how much I think, because it is so neuralgic, And frankly, in the UK, most public opinion is broadly in favour of legal abortion. But people have different positions on limits to that. Mm-hmm. It's very muted, but you see just occasional kind of flare-ups, particularly when there's stuff around disability legislation. That's one of the key things and relates to debates around Down syndrome and genetic disorders and testing and those the ways some of those conversations happen and bubbling underneath what seems like a kind of practical biomedical issue is a conception of what a good life is and which humans we value. How hard do you find it to be a pro-life woman in public who is open about that? And why do you think this is such a divisive and toxic and painful thing to talk about, to the extent that I don't know that I have seen almost nowhere like healthy conversations about differences happening? It's either like all out war or shut down.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most difficult things for me, as I've observed the conversations coming out of our last several years in the United States, is that there is a lot of nuance that has been lost. For instance, a majority of women do desire some limits on abortion in the United States. They're actually more likely to favor limits on abortion than men are. They're not for illegalizing it entirely, but they are oftentimes much more uncomfortable with, for instance, late-term abortions. In addition, a lot of women in the United States, at least, have abortions for financial reasons. And so they oftentimes cite a lack of resources, funds, and support as reasons for feeling that they cannot carry that fetus or baby to term. And so what both of those things tell me, on the first, is that as the Democratic Party and the left has leaned more into extreme abortion coverage all the way to birth and to have late-term abortion be much more a part of our everyday reality, that doesn't actually reflect the wishes of many Americans. On the other hand, many women who have abortions feel that they must have them because they lack support. They don't have the income or the community necessary to feel that they can have a baby at that moment. And in that sense, Republicans and the right have no vocabulary or set of desires around the idea that we should support life in a way that enables women to have the babies that they might want to have, that we're actually coming alongside them and providing pro-family policies, for instance, like paid maternity leave, or coming alongside the poor in terms of the way that we provide welfare in a way that would enable them to carry life to term if they would like to do so. And insofar as both parties have kind of doubled down, they've done so in ways that actually ignore the reality of what people might want or need. And so I have tried to write about how looking only at law, you know, what is legal and what is illegal, passing legislation or voting for politicians that support, you know, a pro-life stance, but who want to do nothing about the actual circumstances in which women feel that they must have an abortion, are ignoring the entire socioeconomic and cultural ground in which abortion becomes a reality. And that if we're going to be pro-life, we have to start coming alongside women and trying to support them in ways that would enable them to carry life to term. And we need to start talking about how in the United States, we have made it so difficult for families to raise children. We have not created a set of circumstances in which it is easy to have a baby. And that is a huge problem. And that is something that must be confronted. And it's both something that can be affected by political policy, and it's something that goes far beyond it in our culture, in our churches, in the businesses that we create and the standards that they have for how a worker should look or act. And so it's much larger and broader than political policy. But once again, if we're going to, on the right, have this conversation about how we believe that the unborn life should be protected, then that is absolutely It is impossible to have that conversation without also looking at the rights and welfare of the mother. And that has been lost in our conversations. And I think that has to be addressed.
Thank you. I want to move on to Uprooted, which is the book that you've recently published, which sits very strongly and openly in the tradition of Wendell Berry, who also, I think, doesn't fit easily in political boxes. In the UK, there's a movement calling itself sort of post-liberal, and I don't know if you've come across that, but it feels like lots of the threads sit there as well, and people can go read it for themselves. But there is there's a kind of metaphor that's a really environmental argument about the soil and the land and the extractive and exploitative nature of global agribusiness that has just decimated the health of the soil and, you know, therefore the prosperity of these communities and their resilience. With this metaphor about human mobility and the rural brain drain, which draws people out of rural communities and into cities, and is often always framed in terms of social status. And the metaphor you use, you know, the phrase that uses people promising children told they will go far. And there's something about literally travel, which is high social status. That cosmopolitanism, that movement, that rootlessness is very much equated with success in our society. And even though you very much sit in that tradition in the sense that you went away and still are away, there's a personal wrestle happening about a pull to home and a kind of civic sense of the consequences of those decisions. I'm sorry, I've just summed up your book for you rather than asking about it, which is ridiculous. Maybe I'll edit that.
You did a better job than I have done in a lot of interviews. I appreciate it.
Well, you had to write 70,000 words on it, so it's harder to go short. But tell me talk to me really personally. When did you start getting, I guess it feels like almost proddings of conscience about the consequences of this personal and then broader uprooting of people?
I think Wendell Berry is really the culprit. I began reading his books in college and they made me very homesick. And they also showed me the beauty in the community in which I'd been raised in a way that I hadn't really fully articulated as a young adult. I've talked to several people about how sometimes you don't know how your place has formed you until you leave it behind, because you're kind of like that fish in water. It's just your atmosphere that you're breathing in. You haven't really realized what it is that it cultivates in you until you step into a new environment. And then you realize whether you fit in or whether you don't, and how those roots in that place have formed your identity, your sense of self, your values, etc. And so coming to the East Coast after being in the rural West was in so many ways a good thing. And I've tried to emphasize that. It's not a book about urban versus rural, in which being urban is a bad thing whatsoever. I've loved getting to be in Washington, D.C. and learned so much from being here. But I also saw that there were all these very tangible goods and beautiful things in that rural life that are completely foreign to a lot of people in Washington, D.C. and to a larger world, which is problematic in this sense for many reasons, but one of them being that rural America is where we grow a lot of our food. It's the site of a lot of economic extraction, and it's an area of our country that has experienced a lot of both ecological and cultural depletion over time. And so as someone who both saw that happening and felt those feelings of homesickness, yet also saw all the goods that I was able to grow in as I was living in a more urban environment, I began to ask myself this set of questions about what I might owe to the past and to place. I lived in an area that I think was far more interdependent and built on the values of a gift economy and of indebtedness than many areas in America. And so I wanted to consider how those kept goodness and flourishing in place, and how the erosion of those things as people leave and thus kind of weaken the strands of community that once existed has led to a point where that community no longer has the same hope for the future that it might have had if the people like me who benefited from those things had stayed in place. Because there is a sense in which we can continue to hand down those lessons, continue to grow those virtues in local soil, and then be able to give them on to the next generation. But as we leave place behind, there's just less opportunity for some of those things to be handed down. And so I wanted to consider how we can both grapple with our uprootedness and whether it might call us to return or to be what I call good transplants, living in the place we're in now and seeking to use those same lessons to bless the communities that we are currently in. And I do think that a place like Washington, D.C., which is full of a lot of mobility as people come and go, can still benefit from all those same lessons I learned as a young person. And so there are ways in which those lessons are, of course, applicable to all sorts of different places and environments.
That bit of your argument was helpful for me, just personally, as someone who grew up in a village and moved to London and has since come to the conclusion that rootedness is important for the health of communities and for our own character development, frankly. But, you know, my family have decided that we are called to root in London, to stick in the city, because the city suffers from almost an opposite way round thing, particularly in London, in that you get a huge insweep of younger, mobile people, and then property prices push people out again. So you get this constant tide, which is constantly undoing sustainable civil society and local institutions. And, you know, we want to live in community in London long term as a way of blessing the city. And so, yeah, I think we share a sense of the importance of sticking. The voice in my head when I was reading this is a friend of mine called Benjamin Ram, who's been a guest on the podcast, who is a culture writer. And we agree on a lot of things, but it drives him nuts when I talk about roots, because he is very much a defender of the value of cosmopolitanism. And he often quotes George Steiner at me, who said, I hope it's George Steiner, it's definitely Benjamin, I'm just going to attribute to him. He says, trees have roots, men have legs, and we are each other's guests. And would very much want to hold on to the sense in which mobility exposes us to other cultures, it expands our horizons, it forms us as, yes, citizens of the world, as well as citizens of one particular place. How much do you hold sway with that argument? How much do you feel the power of that? Or do you feel we've just got too much of that and we need to rebalance?
I think it's a very important, I wouldn't even say counter argument, but an addition to the idea of rootedness, that we are able to travel to live in different environments, different communities, more diverse areas than perhaps the places we came from. And all of that grows our understanding of each other. It should hopefully grow our compassion and our creativity and our ability to love each other well. And it should inform the way we live in our places. I have been thinking about this a lot. We don't have roots, but I would posit that as creatures created by God, we are still called to be gardeners and to tend places well. And that is something you usually are best able to do by rooting yourself in one spot, so that you can observe its health or its brokenness, its various levels of flourishing or depletion, and invest in that place. I've talked in the book about how love can be attention in one direction for a long time, just being very attentive to our environment and what it needs from us, what our families perhaps need from us, but also what our communities need from us. And sometimes you can begin to pick up those cues rather quickly. But I've found that oftentimes it is only really by studying our communities over a long period of time that we can come to understand all that's going on within them. It's the work of a lifetime to love a place well. And I think that as I've looked at the people like my great-grandfather, I've seen that sort of desire to dedicate one's whole life to loving a place well. I don't think everyone's called to it. And I've talked some to people on Twitter and elsewhere about how whether you're in the military or in the ministry or perhaps in a different sort of job you might be forced into or be called to transience of some sort. But I think the call to love a place well, as long as you're there, is still there. And that oftentimes, in fact, if you think about loving a place as if you might die there, transforms the way in which you see it, because you're thinking with this sort of long view that transforms the way you live in a place. And that hopefully helps us to push against some of the consumptive attitudes that we can bring to life in a place.
Thank you so much. I'm going to finish there, even though there's various other things I'd love to talk to you about. But hopefully we can continue a conversation in other formats. Gracie Olmsted, thank you so much for being my guest on The Sacred.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. Remember, sharing is caring, as my four-year-old says. So please do send this or another episode to a friend. Rate us on Apple Podcasts or, my personal favorite, leave us a review. I really get a thrill when I see a new one pop up. Huge thanks to Abby Allison for research and production support and Emily Down for our visual identity. We are edited by Drew Hawley and our music is composed and arranged by Luke Stanley with vocals by Lizzie Harvey. The Sacred is a project of the think tank Theos, and you can find out more about our work at theosthinktank.co.uk.